Good morning and welcome back to Chattering Mess. This is the fun part of the program where we get to listen to what Yahweh, God's one and only name, what he has to tell us. And we are focusing on something that I just enjoy immensely, which is the first three statements that Yahweh etched on the first of the two tablets, because they reveal so much about the terms and conditions of his covenant, so much about his nature, his purpose, and an enormous amount about the consequence of us behaving badly. And there is no better insight into God's nature than the one attribute that he shares with us about himself. Now, you know, there's a lot of symbols that God uses to describe himself. For example, he uses the metaphor of light, which tells us a great deal about him. That means that he is immortal. It means that you can't kill God. You can't extinguish light, for example. It means that explains how he renders prophecy. He's not predicting anything. He is simply sharing with us what he has already witnessed in our future, in our past. Because as light, he's able to witness and experience the past, the present, and future simultaneously. And, you know, light also speaks of the fact that it is not the opposite of darkness. It eliminates darkness. In the presence of light, there is no darkness. And it is the phenomenon that is most helpful in enabling us to be observant. The very thing that Yahweh constantly encourages us to be, to observe, to closely examine and carefully consider what he has shared with us. Light is also energy. And as energy, it is vastly superior to matter. Now, while energy and matter are the same thing, they are not equal. And what I mean by that is that matter, physical nature, our bodies, for example, are matter. They are diminished energy. So we're made out of the same thing. We are literally organized energy. Matter is organized energy. So it's the same substance, but not the equivalent amount of substance. For example, to have the equivalent amount of energy that you find in matter, it's the E equals MC squared, which means that energy is equal to matter or mass times the speed of light times the speed of light. It's interesting, of course, that the very thing that defines the relative size, quantity, if you will, is the speed of light multiplied against itself. And so that tells us, well, that's a metaphor that tells us a lot about God. He uses the metaphor of the cornerstone and the rock of our salvation, the very foundation that is reliable. I talked about how the United States is now a house of cards built on shifting sands. And yet Yahweh uses the term that he is the rock of our salvation because he is dependable. It's a foundation that is reliable, steadfast. You know, he refers to himself as living waters, because water is the universal solvent that cleanses us of our sin, and waters is the source from which life emerges, both human life. We come out of our mother's womb with the breaking of water, and life was conceived in the oceans in water. So there's lots of symbols that God uses to describe himself. There's lots of titles that he attributes to himself. His favorite is Father. His most ubiquitous is Almighty, Elohim. But here he is sharing with us an attribute, an attitude. Now, that's so different. An attitude, an attribute is so remarkably different than is something that is a metaphor. This is not being used metaphorically. Yahweh is saying, I'm going to share and I'm going to etch one attribute with you. And what is that attribute? It's Kana. It reads, for indeed, I, Yahweh, your God, am a zealous and jealous God. Kana El. And then it explains the context of that jealousy, what the result of that jealousy is, which is counting and reckoning the perversity and sin of twisting and distorting of the fathers upon their children concerning the third and fourth generations of those who genuinely hate and are hostile to me. We have my friend Larry on the line. Don't you find it fascinating that God chose to etch one attribute in stone? Now, he also in the same statement is going to say that he is merciful, which is a an attribute of in a way too. But
and obviously they're both attributes. Mercy certainly an attribute, and so is jealousy.
Although I think mercy is more of a mindset than it is an attribute.
Yeah, well, that's true. That's right. That's
mercy is really it's I have chosen. Emotion. Right, I have chosen. It's mercy is I've evaluated the situation, and based upon my evaluation of the situation, I recognize that no one deserves to what I have to offer. But I'm going to choose to give certain people who meet these criterion what I have to offer, even though they haven't earned it. So mercy is really a decision, where Akana is a absolute attribute.
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, the one thing I would say is that, you know, let's, you know, go back to Paul. And Paul, of course, says, you know, love is
not jealous.
It's not jealous. You know.
Yeah. Now let me share something with you, because Scotch and I were discussing this during the break. We were talking about Nick called in and was interested in the individual who is a Christian convert from Islam, the Pakistani that was charged for hate crime, is now suffering deportation case against him in Spain, and we were talking about hate crime. And it wouldn't be a crime not to hate that which is hostile to those you love?
Absolutely.
But think about that. It would really be a crime not to despise that which is harmful to those you love. In fact, you cannot genuinely love unless you are adverse to those things that are hurtful and destructive to those you love. There is no way in the world to love your own children if you are accommodating of those who wish your children harm.
Absolutely. One of the things that always threw me was this idea, this mindset, this notion that, you know, somebody go out and rape and murder your daughter, and you go, but I've forgiven them. You know,
right.
What? Say what? You know,
no.
I mean, nothing changed inside them. They're still the same people that they were when they did it. And you somehow overcome it all by loving them and forgiving them. And you know, that's not my mindset.
No, I know there's a guy in Texas who watched, who came upon one of his employees raping his 6 to 8 year old, I think it was maybe an 8 year old daughter, and he killed him. And I'm here to tell you that if I don't have daughters, but if I saw a man raping, if I had a daughter and I saw a man raping her, I'd kill him. Absolutely, I'd kill him. Wouldn't think twice about it, wouldn't have any remorse about it, don't even care what would happen to me afterwards.
It'd be like swatting a fly. I understand that. I mean,
there are things worthy of hating. I despise pedophilia. Despise it. And so if someone is engaging in pedophilia, then we ought to care enough, love enough, that we are opposed to them, that we are hostile to them, that we hate them. You look at the Roman Catholic Church. How many tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands, of little boys whose lives they have absolutely ruined because of their propensity to commit pedophilic acts and for the church institution as a whole to cover them up?
Absolutely.
If you don't hate the institution that created the environment where hundreds of thousands of boys could have their lives ruined in this way, then I'm telling you, you aren't capable of love.
That's right. That's absolutely right. You must be a pretty empty vessel there.
Yeah, so when God says that he's jealous, that he's zealous, he's telling us a great deal. He's saying, you know, I am the kind of father that you all ought to be. I am capable of love. He's saying the exact opposite of what Paul said. I am capable of love. I am demonstrating love. I genuinely love because I am absolutely intolerant of those things that are harmful to my children.
Well, nobody with a right mind is going to accuse Yahweh of lack of passion. He's passionate.
Yes.
That means when a person's passionate, that means they can hate passionately.
You are not capable of love unless you can hate. You are not capable of hate, real hate, unless you also understand something of love. Now, typically it is, I might correct myself there. I know there's a lot of people who are enraged and indoctrinated to hate, Muslims in particular, and they know nothing of love. So it may be possible to hate without knowing love, but I can tell you it is impossible to love without knowing hate. Because as God says here, that he literally despises the perversity and sin of twisting and distorting his testimony because of what it does, what fathers do to their children concerning the third and fourth generations, and that by twisting and distorting his testimony, they're demonstrating, rather than their reverence for God, their devotion to God, they're demonstrating their hostility to him.
I want to throw one other thing in here, the notion that Yahweh is all love.
Well, of course, that'd be stupid.
Nonsense. He's not an emotion. He is a being of pure energy with emotions. And this is a completely, this is another step away from the twisting of the truth, you know.
Right.
That's the truth. And yet we have people out there, you know, promoting veganism because God loves so much. You know, well, then why does a lion have to eat a zebra?
Right.
I mean, really?
Didn't God create both a lion and a zebra?
Yeah, sure he did. You know?
Okay, well, why is Passover have us slaughter the Passover lamb so that we can be nourished by its flesh? Why are we a being that our brains only operate effectively and our bodies only operate effectively if nourished with proteins?
Yeah, that's right.
Why do we have canines? Why do we have canines?
We have to chew meat.
Yes, that is absolutely correct. You know, one of the things here that's often missed in this particular statement is that if God says that that he's counting and reckoning the perversity and sin of twisting and distorting of the fathers upon their children, does that not mean that God has allowed men to twist and distort his testimony and that there's a consequence of having done so? Doesn't it mean that the Christian myth, I can't believe God would ever allow anyone to corrupt his word, is inconsistent with Yahweh's word? Welcome back to Shattering Myths. We have Steve calling in. Larry, you're locked in, calling in from Washington. He wants to join the conversation on this topic. And then perhaps in the next segment we'll go to Glenn, who called in just shortly after Steve. But Steve, welcome to the program.
Hi, Larry.
Larry's with us. That's just fine. As you got Larry and Yada here.
Well, look, you know, a lot of times I've thought about what we're talking about. What I want to know is why has there never, ever been a father that's ever stood up and said, you know, to the Catholic Church, pedophiles, why have you raped my little boy? Now you're going to die. Not one time have we ever heard of any father standing up and executing judgment. You know, if I had a son and they did that to my son, excuse me, but now you're gonna die. I'm sorry if that's over the top, but that's what I would do. And
you know,
why has that not ever happened?
Yeah, it's interesting, Steve. Before I respond to it, Larry, I'd like to hear your view as well. It's important that we have a pause here and to say, I do not advocate violence. Never do I advocate violence. I'm just telling you, in the one example, if I saw someone in the process, if I had a daughter and I saw someone raping my daughter as the an 8-year-old daughter like the man did in Texas, I would have responded as he did. And I would have had no remorse on doing so. I'm not recommending that anybody take the law into their own hands and kill anyone, including those who are acting badly. But I can tell you that if you are a loving father, as Steve has presented this case here, and you know for certain that the priest of a Roman Catholic Church has not only sodomized your son, but that he is he's being protected by the Roman Catholic Church, and that he is given the opportunity to sodomize more children, that if you are a genuinely loving father, it would be very difficult to restrain that kind of an individual from wanting to do what Steve has suggested by personally holding the perpetrator accountable for their actions, since the court system doesn't seem to be willing to do it, and the Roman Catholic Church is actually coddling and protecting them. Why hasn't there been cases amongst the hundreds of thousands of young boys who have been sodomized by Roman Catholic priests? Why hasn't there been a single father of any of those children who has responded and taken action against the perpetrator?
Right, not one.
Not one. Now, well, I suspect the reason is... go ahead, Larry.
I think there's several reasons. I think you got deflection for one right away. You know, we didn't do it. No matter who you are, you don't want to think you're killing somebody that's innocent, you know.
Right.
And then you're within a paradigm that they created, which is the court system and bribery.
Yes.
And the next thing you know, there's a big check for $2 million if you let this thing go away.
Yes.
Yeah,
that's how that works.
But hey, guys, why not one? Not one.
No, I know. I know.
Why?
I think the reason is that most children who are in that position to be sodomized by the Roman Catholic Church are there because their fathers are devoted to the Roman Catholic Church. That's what Yah was saying here. It's the fathers corrupt and pervert their own children. And so they're there because the fathers believe the Roman Catholic Church is the means to their salvation. And so the fathers have been corrupted. They have been twisted by their fathers. And now they're twisting and perverting their own children. And so the issue is, if you're a Roman Catholic parent and you're sending your child to be in that Roman Catholic Church, you are as guilty for having them be sodomized as is the priest who actually performs the act. You know, if you know, for example, that a lion is starving and it hasn't eaten in weeks, and you think, hey, it would be okay for me to allow someone to throw my child before that lion, then is it the lion's fault or your fault?
God.
So
well,
I think
you know
this,
what you would think that. In hundreds of years, that there would be one of us nut jobs that finally broke from the pack and decided, hey, you raped my boy, I'm going to do something about it. And it never happened. And that is just unbelievably to me that this hasn't happened.
Yep. Steve, thank you for your call. We're going to the commercial break, but I think the answer is the father is as guilty as the pedophile. Hello, and welcome back to Shattering Myths. When we were in the last segment, we were talking with Steve about why there, at least that we are unaware of an example, and over the period of time where hundreds of thousands of young boys have been sodomized by the Roman Catholic Church in pedophilic acts, and where the church has gone to protect the priests and have moved them around so they could sodomize more boys, has not responded by personally taking matters into his own hand and holding the pedophile priest accountable. And while it may have happened in the past, and my answer to you, Steve, is that I think that in these situations, the person who actually bears the most guilt, and maybe it's not the most guilt, but certainly bears an enormous amount of guilt, is the dad. They are the ones who foolishly trusted this institution. They're the ones who subjected their children, their son, to the pedophiles. I mean, today, there is no secret that priests are pedophiles. If you are a father and you send your son to the Roman Catholic Church, you are absolutely as guilty as the priest who may sodomize him. It's kind of like, in a more modest way, the choosing to smoke today. Everyone knows that if you smoke, it's going to increase your chance of cancer. And so if you get cancer, you ought not blame the cigarette companies for making a carcinogenic product. You ought to blame yourself for choosing to smoke. And that's the way I look at this. I think that the parents know that they are culpable in this. That's what God is saying here, that the parents, the fathers, are culpable in this regard. So I hope that helps and answers your question. I don't have a perfect answer, of course, because we're talking about the most heinous of human behavior and what our response is to this savaging of our children by a religious institution, the largest religious institution on earth. That at least provides some semblance of an answer, Steve, to your question.
Am I still here?
Yes, you are.
Look, the point I might want to make is the fact that of all the thousands of times that this has happened to these little boys, that we're not talking about wimps all along
right.
the way. Along the way, there had to have been at least one a solid Marine or something that stood up for his own boy.
Yeah.
The fact is that that religion is so thoroughly evil that even a solid person
couldn't
stand up for his own child.
Yeah, think about the fact that 30,000 boys have been known to have been sodomized by the Roman Catholic Church in Ireland alone. Ireland's a pretty small country. And the Irish are pretty rugged individuals. The climate makes them rugged, and they are impulsive. I mean, I'm Irish and Sioux Indian, and so I know that being Irish, I'm impulsive, and so you would think in a country where 30,000 young boys have been sodomized by the Roman Catholic Church, that one Irishman would have stood up and held them personally accountable for doing so. So you've got a great point. Steve, I need to go on to Glenn, but thank you so much for calling. Glenn, welcome to the program. I understand you have a comment on graven images.
Actually, like to comment on what you guys were just talking about. Okay, obviously pedophilia is horrible. Whatever it is found, it's especially heinous when it's committed by trusted leaders and people who are supposed to be spiritual purveyors of truth. That's obviously especially heinous. But given the magnitude, the culturally widespread magnitude of the problem, I think it's also important to recognize that nowadays, the vast majority of incidents of pedophilia are committed by secularists because that's who populates the culture by and large. The magnitude of the problem cannot be accounted for by the religious offenders.
Yeah, I'm going to agree with you on your first point, and I don't know the answer on your second, but I at least want to talk about it. All pedophilia is horrid. I think it's the single most grievous crime that a person can commit. And I want to agree that that pedophilia, when conducted by a societal leader, particularly a religious leader, is the worst form of pedophilia. That disgusting does have grades. And that when pedophilia is committed by someone who is purporting to represent God, and providing the means to salvation, and they commit an act of pedophilia on a child and tell that child that if they speak, they'll be damned to hell, that is the worst form of pedophilia. So there's a special stigma in the Roman Catholic Church. Now, I don't know the overall national crime statistics worldwide or even in America on the percentage of pedophilic acts that have been perpetrated by per capita.
Well, the numbers are staggering. You know, yeah. The numbers are staggering, and religious part of the population simply can't account for it all.
Yeah, well, I will certainly agree that pedophilic acts are committed outside of Roman Catholicism. I think if you were to look at a per capita incidence, you know, if you're comparing all of America, for example, to the Roman Catholic Church, and you say all of America committed 10,000 pedophilic acts, and the Roman Catholic Church committed 3,000 pedophilic acts, the onus would still be on the Roman Catholic Church because its representatives, its priests, number in the thousands of, as opposed to the hundreds of millions.
Yeah, when you look at white slavery, the abduction, I think perhaps you might want to look a little bit more into the magnitude of kidnapping and white slavery.
Yeah.
I think you'll be brought
yeah.
up on your heels when you see what the numbers actually are.
Well, yeah, you look at Thomas Jefferson, for example. Thomas Jefferson with a young woman, probably a girl when at the time that he first had sex with her, chose to have sex with a slave. There is no other way to describe having sex with a young slave as other than rape or pedophilia. You have total control over them. And Thomas Jefferson, we know for certain, committed, had sexual relations with a young slave girl. And yes, it was extraordinarily common in the early days of America that slave owners had sex with their slaves. And so it is a pervasive evil. I'm not going to deny the fact it is a pervasive evil.
That's why you're putting Thomas Jefferson on a moral pedestal. More importantly, Dawkins elders right now, Bill Clinton's Surgeon General, is advocating not just the teaching of masturbation to young children, but the actual interaction with young children at very early ages in performing masturbation on young children. That's Dawkins elders, ex-Surgeon General, naval officer, secularist. But
yeah.
I also have a secular organization, North American Man Boy Love Association, secular organization, openly advocating pedophilia.
Glenn, I'm going to put you on hold, and not because of what you've said. What you said is appropriate, but we have a really bad echo on your telephone. Larry, I want to make a comment on what Glenn has said, and then I want to invite you to do it as well. One of the things that I'm always uncomfortable doing is getting in a comparative contest with what is the greater of evils. Roman Catholicism has sanctioned pedophilia and has covered up and abetted pedophilia for a very long time. Socialist secular humanism has also created an atmosphere that encourages grotesque interactions that are incestuous and pedophilic. And Glenn's comment in terms of a secular humanist leader in America advocating these kinds of things reinforces that. But beyond the fact that socialist secular humanism and Roman Catholicism are both evil, misguided, grotesquely immoral, I'm not sure there's much to be gained by the comparative of who's worse.
That's my thought. They're one and the same to me. It doesn't matter. I mean, what's the difference between worshiping a false god and saying there is no god, putting man on a pedestal? What's the difference?
In most religions, man becomes god. You know, in Christianity, Paul's creation of his Jesus Christ, who is a caricature based upon the mythology of Dionysus, became his god, and that Paul was the source of scripture. So you put man on a pedestal. In Islam, there is no way to differentiate between Muhammad and Allah. They speak with the same voice. They share the same words. They are one and the same. And so what is really the difference? And Buddhism, Buddha, a man, becomes divine. And so there really is no difference in that. And, you know, when I spent a summer back in my youth in the old USSR, and also spent a summer in China during the first year that it was opened for Western visitors, one of the things that I noticed is that everywhere, it was absolutely overwhelming and ubiquitous, is that there were statues and huge billboards that had chiseled caricatures of men, making men bigger than life and giving them stone-like features. And always they would be the slogan of that individual, some scriptural antidote to live by. And, you know, it became such that in the Soviet Union and in all of the Eastern Bloc countries controlled by communism, as well as in China, literally men were turned into gods.
Right.
So there really is no difference, I don't think, from a religious perspective, from a propaganda and a beguiling perspective between religion and politics as it relates to the blend of religion and politics and socialist secular humanism and pure religions like Christianity and Islam. In fact, Islam is equal parts politics and religion. So from that perspective, it is it's important to recognize that all of these mantras are specifically designed to deceive. You know, today people are comfortable attacking Nazism. Very few people have read Mein Kampf. They don't know what Nazism actually represented. They just know that it was deadly. And so we have to be cognizant of the fact that Hitler in Mein Kampf, his primary objective was to promote a replacement religion to the Christian religion that he was attacking. And so a political dogma had a enormous religious component, as does socialist secular humanism today. Hello, welcome back to Shattering Myths. This is our last segment for today. We have Larry on the line with us. We're considering the second of three statements that Yahweh etched on the first of the two tablets, which are now memorialized in the Torah. They're memorialized two places in the Torah. One is in Devarim, where Moshe is summarizing what Yahweh has taught us, and the other is in the book known as Exodus, which is actually Shemoth, which means names. This particular statement we were reading, which is part of that third statement, was from 25, and it is not a commandment. There is no imperative mood ascribed to any of these words. Yahweh is telling us that he is protective, that he is kana, that he is desirous of exclusivity in a relationship, and he is emotionally passionate and protective of those he loves. And that was the issue that we got into as to how, as a dad, should we behave? And God is presenting himself here as a father. But Larry, there's something here I'd like to consider, and I don't know if I'm extrapolating too far or not, but when God says that he is protective, that he is jealous, that he wants an exclusive relationship, and then the next word out of his mouth is counting and reckoning the perversity and sin of twisting and distorting of the fathers upon their children concerning the third and fourth generation, is he not in a very real way saying that I don't want you abusing your children, that he's speaking here of spiritual pedophilia?
Oh, yeah. I mean, he's obviously talking about spiritual murder. I mean, sure he is. Absolutely.
The abuse. He's talking about the abuse of children. Fathers abusing their own children. So this is the worst kind of pedophilia. You know, there is, I guess, a higher calling in pedophilia. There's the run-of-the-mill, I have no relationship, I'm just a creep pedophile. Then there's the religious pedophile, which is a horrible form. But, you know, there may be a form of pedophilia even worse, and this is the form that is being listed here. When fathers abuse their own children.
And that's why we know when we get into further, you know, honor your father and your mother.
Right.
He's not talking about your father and your mother. He just excoriated, right, you know, people for murdering their own kids. You know,
right, for corrupting their own kids.
through religious means. And, you know, if we could ever get across to people that religion is an abomination, it's the man's invention, you know, it's man throwing himself in the middle and pretending to be an intermediary to Yahweh, and that Yahweh wants a relationship, set up a Berith covenant, based on Ba'ath, based on home and family, and men invented religion. And you know, you can start right from Judaism right on down the line as it gets worse, and it just keeps getting worse and worse and worse.
Yeah. The reality is that Awon defines religion. Every religion is based upon twisting and perverting something God said. I mean, you look at Paul's New Testament. It's based not on whole new cloth, but based on a corruption and a perversion, a distorting of what Yahusha said and did, and who Yahweh is, and what he shared with us.
He called it a whitewash job.
And then you look at Islam. He didn't create his religion out of whole cloth. No, he plagiarized and bastardized the Talmud, which was a corruption of what Yahweh had said. So it's a corruption two times over.
And that's why it's so bizarre.
Right. Look at Buddhism. It's a derivative of Hinduism. So religion is the ultimate form of twisting and distorting. And what God is putting together here is this concept of as a father, he is naturally protective. He's passionate, kana, and zealous. Kana depicts paying the price to acquire something valuable. And it speaks of redemption, which is what Yahweh, as a father, is willing to sacrifice himself for his children. And if you're willing to sacrifice yourself for your children, then you're absolutely going to be opposed to those who will undermine, who will corrupt and pervert what you have done for them. You know, here's God saying, I am willing to, and I actually have now, sacrifice myself so that you can be part of my family and live with me forever. Now, would you not naturally be opposed, hate, despise those who would corrupt what you have done, would distort it and say, none of that even matters. You ought not consider Yahweh's Passover sacrifice or his matzah sacrifice. All you ought to look at is that man killed God, and that this God magically bodily rose the next day, bodily resurrection, even though no one recognized him. And you ought to replace what Yahweh has actually done with this myth. Wouldn't you be angry if you were God? We'll be with you this time tomorrow. May God bless you all.